And now I'm here with Kyle Cobb. He is the co-founder and CTO of Advanced Farm. He is in the trenches as an entrepreneur, as part of the founding team here at Advanced Farm. But okay, so I want to give a quick intro of you. You are part of the founding team of Greenbotics, a solar panel cleaning company. You guys were acquired by SunPower in 2013. And now Advanced Farms, you guys are developing a strawberry harvesting robot, and you're backed by Impact Ventures, and I know other venture capitalists, along with Yamaha Motors, the Kubota Corporation. And my hope today is, Brian gave me a list of things that we might want to talk about today, talking about getting your idea to launch, really from beginning to end. So you were there at the beginning. Where are you at now in finding the, you know, what problem you're solving, how you figured the market fit, along with choosing your investment partners. I think that's interesting as an investor, and then also the strength of the team and really your vision for the future. So I think we set up the show with some topics to cover, but let's get to know you a little bit. Kyle, why don't you just give us a little bit of your background and how you guys dreamt up this idea?
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks again for having me. I was born in Sacramento a long time ago and grew up in Atlanta, Georgia as a kid. I came back to Sacramento area up to Chico for high school, which is an important fact because that's where I met Mark Grossman, our CEO, our co-founder, about 20 years ago. We went off on our kind of separate ways.
And you met him in high school?
Met him in high school.
Okay, interesting. Where you meet people in bonds? Were you guys close then, or did you guys just know each other?
Yeah, no, we were close then, you know, and we'd always kicked around a lot of silly business ideas, amateur kid business ideas, but grew up to do the same thing, which was pretty cool.
Crazy.
So, yeah, and so we went our separate ways, and he went on to the engineering route and went to Caltech and studied mechanical engineering, and I did finance at UCLA and ended up, you know, going into banking, and he went into engineering for a solar company, and we got back together after we'd each had a couple of jobs out of school. Mark had this tremendous idea as the solar industry was booming in California to get into robotic solar panel cleaning. People would build these massive solar projects out in the desert without really realizing that, you know, 6 months go by in California without rain, and there's also no one living in the desert and no water. So it's really hard to find a way to clean them, and your production's down 30%, you're scrambling. And so luckily, Mark and a couple other friends of his from Caltech got together, brought me along with them, and we started this business called Greenbotics, also based in Davis, where we tried to address this growing problem of solar panel cleaning, and we had bootstrapped it, had a great time, and came on to the next thing.
That's exciting. Okay, so the next thing is you're picking strawberries, right? Is that you again? You're in the robotic world. How did you come up with this idea?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, being in Davis, which is a great ag community, we are inspired by all the problems that farmers are facing. And so coming out of SunPower, we were sort of looking around and trying to figure out how we could apply our skills in robotics to some farming application. And so, you know, like many businesses, the first thing we did was just start asking a lot of questions. And so we kept asking, you know, growers across the different crops where there were challenges that might be addressed with robotics, and this topic of strawberry harvesting kept coming back. Strawberries are a really labor-intensive crop. They're unlike a lot of crops. They're harvested every 2 or 3 days all year round. And so, and it's really also pretty awful work. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sort of a great opportunity to get robotics involved, but it's also a really challenging technical problem. And so, you know, for both of those reasons, we decided that we would try our hand in it. And I'll talk a little bit more as we go about, you know, how we've made progress since then.
You bet. Well, okay. So thinking about identifying the problem, maybe walk us through this for our audience. Do you drive out to a farm and start asking questions, and you realize that certain chores are labor intensive? So you see that as the problem? I mean, or is it phone calls? How did you do your product research?
Well, luckily, UC Davis is a great agricultural university with tons of data at, you know, available for the public. And okay. So the first step for us is just looking at some of the case studies that have been gathered over the years. How much are people spending on you know, cultivation in this crop or harvesting in this crop. And you can pretty quickly see that the sheer market opportunity of strawberry harvesting is quite big. It's about $1 billion in California when you look at about, you know, $25,000-$30,000 per acre spent each year on harvesting and about 30,000 to 40,000 acres being planted. And so that really trumps a lot of the other opportunities available. And so the first step was looking at the numbers, and then it was understanding the problem and unfolding it a little bit by seeing, you know, what the technical challenges would be, what the market challenges would be with getting to know customers and you know, setting the growth strategy and things like that. But really, it all starts with running the numbers.
Well, you think about the, you guys started in 2013?
2017.
Oh, 2017. Okay, yeah. So, I mean, there's been and there's an increasing shortage of a labor force, right? So we know that unemployment is super low. Is it a lot tougher to get somebody to go pick strawberries these days too? I mean, is that causing the price of strawberries to be a lot higher? What problem are you really solving?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's very hard work. It's very challenging work for the people that are involved in picking. And so I think that leads to a lot of growers to facing a shortage of labor to do the work, as you said, and, you know, and especially in a time of full employment. Couple that with growing costs on the labor side, with increasing minimum wage and overtime laws changing, that puts a lot of pressure on the cost side. And of course, you know, as price sensitive consumers, there's a certain ceiling that we'll pay for strawberries before we just go start buying apples. So growers are kind of feeling it from both sides, where their cost structure is increasing, having a really hard time finding people to do this really hard work. And they can't just pass on increasing costs to the consumer. So there's a really good opportunity for someone to come in and help stabilize costs and bridge the gap in supply.
So you decided to go after strawberries initially, right? That was, you know, that was a decision. Because a lot of times you hear companies, the business plan changes. You could have tried to go after some other fruit or some other crop. But you picked the right one first, because it turns out that this is, I mean, there's a huge need. Has it gone smoothly? How would you characterize the process over these last couple years?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say, you know, it seems very deliberate in retrospect, but there was always, you know, the 6 months before we decided to really focus on strawberries, where you're kicking around all kinds of crazy ideas. And again, you run the numbers, you look at the technical challenges, and you quickly dismiss that. But like many businesses with strawberries, what we found is more and more time was being spent on the problem. Because it was a really interesting technical problem. We were being reinforced by our customers, you know, or by our potential customers, that it was a problem, in fact, that they valued and that they needed a solution for. And then as the team just started spending more and more time on it, you know, it snowballs into something that becomes a full-time job that you're dedicated to. And so has it been smooth along the way? No, of course not. You know, developing hardware is really hard. And luckily, we have a super talented technical team. And I can say that because I'm not a part of it. I'm watching them work in awe most of the time. And so they've made it look easy at times. But I think what differentiates us is our ability and our willingness to do the really hard work and to solve really hard technical problems and go out and spend hours and hours out on a farm in tough conditions.
So getting the first products out there, obviously it takes a while to build them and then go make them work, the testing, the prototyping. I mean, how do you know when it's good enough to actually take it to market? Or are you there yet?
Yeah, you know, I think it's for us, it was a lot of listening to our customers and buying down the risks accordingly. So I think there's a temptation to take on a lot, especially as you understand the problem. You know, for us, we had no idea what the ultimate solution would look like. But the thing that for example, using our story as an example, the thing that kept coming up was farmer skepticism that we couldn't handle the fruit gently enough to, you know, with a robot to sell then to a consumer, to a very picky consumer, right?
Right.
And so that was obviously the first risk we buy down, is go down. And before you build a big robot that, you know, can drive down the row, you focus on the smallest technical problem you can to buy down that risk, and then convince yourself that you've done enough to take on the next part of the problem.
Yeah.
And so that's where we started.
Because those little robot hands, they're like hands, and they pick the strawberry. Is that right? Is that how it works? And they have to not bruise the strawberry.
That's
right. Is that the idea?
That's right. You know, we went through 50 versions of a gripper that that could go down and pick fruit gently in a way that pulls it off of the plant without damaging the plant or the fruit. Keeping the little bush on the top, the calyx on the top of the berry in a way that consumers are happy with. And so that took a lot of time, but ultimately we're happy with it.
How would you compare your grippers to the human hand in terms of quality of pick?
Yeah, great question. So again, that was basically the question we kept having to answer for our growers. And so the way we answer it is you have a human picker pick several boxes, and then you have a robotic picker pick several boxes, and you keep them in the boxes of fruit in the refrigerator over many days, and then you test the quality and you compare and see where there's little thumbprints or bruises. And I'm pleased to say that we're able to pick in a way that is competitive with humans.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah. And the robot doesn't call in sick.
Not always.
That's interesting. So you can pick it just as well. And strawberries have to be picked quite often, right? So what's the season for a strawberry?
Right. So the 90% of the nation's strawberries are grown here in California. The other 10% in Florida. And so what that looks like in California is berries are planted in September, October timeframe, and then they start to be harvested in January down in Oxnard, just north of Los Angeles. And then a couple months after that, up in San Luis Obispo, it gets warm enough and berries start coming. And then finally in the Monterey, Salinas, Watsonville area. And it's basically every 2 or 3 days you're out there picking berries off of the plant until it gets too hot and the plants get overgrown basically in summertime. So
and there's no, you're not getting any functionality out of the robots during the downtime, right? So when we'd normally send the workers to do something else, maybe they'll do construction or some other job, the machines stand down during that period of time. So you're kind of comparing against a seasonal worker. Is that right? Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, although, you know, the season is quite long, luckily, because it's right here in California and the weather is sort of perfect for berries. You know, we can pick berries 9-10 months out of the year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's pretty much all year. Okay. Yeah.
Which is, again, a great reason to start with strawberries, right? We get a lot of quick cycles of R&D and we can stay busy all year.
And when did you talk to us about the raising money piece? As the CFO, I'm sure a lot of this sort of fell over into your lap, determining how are we going to get this baby funded. How did you go about making those decisions?
Yeah. So first thing is we put a fair amount of our own time and money into the business to get to the point where we had something that was that we could convince ourselves was a real business, right? Because if you can't convince yourself, then there's no hope convincing investors. And so what that looked like for us was getting to the point where we could pick a berry gently enough and fast enough on sort of a prototype basis, you know, over certain windows of time to show that we had some promise in our technology. So with that, that was spring of 2018.
So that took you about 12 months to get there? How long did it take you?
Yeah, about 9 months, I would say.
Okay, that's pretty quick. So you had 9 months of putting your own money in. This is a time where you're working without a paycheck type thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's your own money, your own time.
Yep.
You guys are full. How many people full-time when you're starting?
Four.
Four people full-time and doing that with your own money. Okay.
Yeah.
So 9 months in, okay, we're going to go out to market. Who did you decide to... did you go right after venture capital or did you have a round of early angels?
So I should also mention that, you know, our previous business we bootstrapped and we raised some friends and family money for, but, you know, this was kind of our first time going out to venture. Mm. And so we have learned a lot over the last two rounds of raising money. But what we, at that point, you know, there's so much information available on the web that you get a list of 100 companies and you slowly over the course of a process of raising money get smarter about which ones are likely candidates. And I'd say, honestly, so much of it comes down to networking, which I know is I found to be really critical and I should just say, a big part of, I think, what's cool about Sacramento's ecosystem, as we were talking about before, there's just so many people that seem to be connected to others that can be helpful. Mm-hmm. And so that was it, just taking the meetings, getting introductions, and then slowly finding partners that understand how challenging it is to do hardware and farming. And luckily, we found a great partner.
C- Can I ask you about the networking piece? Because a lot of people wonder if it's a waste of time, right? So you and I were at Five Star Bank Tank recently. I was emceeing. I've done that the last couple of years. It's a good place to network. So there's different events. And how do you sort between the event that's good for networking when you're raising money and the event that feels more like, I don't know, sometimes the Chamber of Commerce meeting, people are just trying to sell each other stuff. It feels like, you know, no disparagement against the chamber, but it's not where you go to raise money.
You know, I think from my experience, it's sort of as simple as taking the meeting and having a long view on relationships. You know, it's sort of easy, especially when, you know, you're spending your own money, you're trying to raise money, you're feeling the pressure. It's really easy to make things transactional when you're meeting people. But what I found is that, you know, the smallest little connections can end up being really fruitful and really valuable, and you can learn a lot from people. So I'd say just going into it, just being really humble and genuine with most people that you meet, even if it's in an event that you don't expect, those are sometimes the connections that I find to be really
I would agree best. With that. Just to kind of add to what you said, so I'm now invested into a lot of companies here in the Sacramento area, and it's random how I've ran into them. It's like it might be some kind of party that is not even about fundraising, but you sort of get that introduction. Next thing you know, there's a connection, and you know, and that it's interesting how you never know who you're talking to, type thing.
Right.
Okay. So you decide you're going to raise some money. How did you identify how much you need to raise and who the right partner might look like?
Yeah. So, it's, you know, my background is in investment banking. So luckily I've got some experience looking at smaller companies from a big company who wants to acquire those companies. And so, you know, having a really good understanding of forecasting has helped. And so, you know, I did my best to put together a forecast, put together a really inspiring pitch, and go out and meet with companies that were writing the checks in the size that we thought we wanted, that would be interested in the sectors that we were participating in, and then ultimately, you know, that seemed to have the right sort of fit from a cultural perspective, which is something, you know, after you get to, you know, take meetings with people, if you're lucky to have the opportunity to sort of filter between those all those all the way down and have a really good partner. Which is where we landed, then I think that's a great start.
Well, who was the first partner?
Oh, so we had a lead investor called Catapult Ventures, based down in Silicon Valley, and Impact Venture Capital as well, a firm based here in Sacramento. And then again, relationships are really important to us, so we had some friends and family who wanted to take a bet on us, and
you let them in simultaneously.
We let them in, and we're happy to have them. You know, often what we find is there's some value in having a partner with expertise, but then there's also value in having partners that just provide the best moral support.
Yeah.
You know, when times are tough and you got to call and ask someone for inspiration, then it's an old friend, you know, who can call and say, God, that's really cool. You know, send more pictures. Mm-hmm. And so that was important to us.
Well, I guess there's probably, I have to assume after talking to a lot of entrepreneurs, that it can be a double-edged sword to take on investment from friends and family, because especially in an early stage company, there's a lot at risk. So it has to be something. My advice to people is typically, you know, you don't want to take your the last dollar of your grandmother, right, as an investment. It needs to be money that people could afford to lose, because it is risky, and nobody wants bad blood if there's, you know, if it doesn't go as well as expected.
Totally. Definitely only take money from accredited investors, right? That's a key point, that so that they can afford to lose the money, and presumably they have some understanding of just how risky their investment is.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm invested into as a limited partner into Impact, but you said the lead investor was Catapult. So they came in. What happened? You first had the romance with them, and then they brought in Impact. How did that work?
No, you know, actually, what often happens, I find, is there's several horses in the race, and at the end, you know, one emerges as kind of a lead investor for one reason or another, whether it's better terms or a better fit or, you know, timing issues. And then you sort of have to keep a few things going in order for the round to come together as you want, and for you to have a, you know, a diverse set of investors, and also things happen and things fall through. And so fortunately, we got the support of Impact kind of alongside Catapult, as well as the friends and family I mentioned. And then we closed that round in November 2018.
Okay. And yeah, our buddy Jack Crawford is one of the partners over there. Great guy. Great for the Sacramento region in terms of igniting the ecosystem here. He's been on the show many times. Good man. Okay, so you get this initial round, and that was geared to last you how long in your forecast?
Yeah, a couple years.
Couple years.
Tough years.
Okay. Sounds like we're gonna get into some juicy stuff. Why was it tough?
Well, you know, when I say a couple tough years, when you raise that first round of money, or when we raised the round of money, it's this balance of, you know, accepting enough dilution, I would say, to get the new investor excited and to get the amount of money that you actually need to run the business, but not expecting to go straight into, you know, a rosy lifestyle. And so making sacrifices where you can to stretch the money as long as you can. Mm-hmm. So when I say a couple tough years, I mean, you know, we decided to start taking salaries at that point, but not market salaries. And we wanted to, there's a temptation to expand your team big time, but we hired a few people and we wanted to buy down that next risk so that when we went back out and to extend our runway even further, you know, we had raised our valuation.
Curious about how, you know, we're having an event here coming up in a couple of months. We're going to be talking about valuing a company and, you know, and how much, and some of, and when you do that, you're thinking about the dilution aspect, sure, right? That's a factor. When you and your co-founder were thinking about dilution, I mean, is there like a certain amount you're like, I don't want to go below X because we, obviously the economics might not look as good, but then control?
You know, I'd say at the early stages, it's less about control and actually less about dilution and more about finding the right partner. I think what we did that helped there were two things. One is we'd had success with an exit before, which is, you know, I think to investors especially, it's an indication that we have experienced a lot of the pain that maybe a first-time founder wouldn't have, and hopefully we're smarter the second time around. And the second thing is that I would encourage everyone to do is just try your best to, you know, devote as much time and energy and money as you can on to get as far along as you can before you accept outside investment. I think that's not only good for keeping dilution low, or raising your valuation, in other words, but it's also it's a healthy practice for yourself to convince, like I said, convince yourself that you have a real business, mm-hmm, and to go through a lot of the hurdles that you probably need to go through before you really buckle down to the startup life for a few years.
What was the biggest hurdle that you went through that first couple of years? What's the biggest hurdle that you maybe tripped on even?
Oh, good question. You know, I think, there are so many technical hurdles that you have to get over when you're building hardware there's, you know, I could, everything from, like I said, 50 versions of the gripper, you know, I don't think I'm exaggerating, 50 versions of the gripper until you get one right, to, you know, really detailed implementations, integrations with robotic arms and software, and all of those things are not trivial. And so there's just, you know, having the tenacity to stick to it and go out in the field, like I said, and solve the problems on the farm in the middle of the night. Like, those are tough conditions.
Were you ever worried that we might not get this fast enough? We could run out of time for the amount of funding we had. I mean, some people,
sure,
right? Some people think about quitting when things are tough. I mean, did you guys ever go through any of that kind of stretch where you're like, wow, we might not make this?
Sure. I think, you know, that's a risk that, that everyone goes through. But I think what's helped us mitigate that risk is, this trust that we've developed in one another after knowing each other for 20 years and working with each other really closely in really hard conditions for 5 or 10 years. You know, you sort of have to, I'm sure you know the importance of knowing your co-founders well, and it really helps to have been through that once before with them, and knowing how, you know, looking at each other, knowing how hard everyone's willing to work to get there.
Yeah. I have seen infighting, right? When times get tough, you really test, I guess, the strength of the team, and especially when you're talking about the co-founders. So yeah, I can see that you and your buddy from high school, right? You built something together. You knew how to battle. You knew how to fight together. I can see that being a huge advantage. And as an investor, when I see those kind of relationships, it's a quicker yes, for sure, mm-hmm, when I see that, because one of the biggest risks we see is you know, just leadership teams not working together, that can derail any, that can put the company out of business. So, but okay, thinking about this, so you ultimately decided to bring in a couple of, what do you call these, strategic venture partners? I'm thinking of like Kubota. Are these, how do you consider them as partners? Are they financial partners for you? Are they more than that?
Yeah. So, so we took the round last year from purely venture capital firms and then some friends and family. We went through another spring of, you know, revised hardware prototype, a bunch of testing, hit some great company milestones, and then started looking for our next set of partners. And as you point out, we brought on Yamaha Motor Ventures and Kubota Corporation, which is a big tractor company, basically, integrated farming and tractor company. And for us, we went out to a lot of venture firms and some strategic companies as well. And I think we couldn't have found better partners for a couple of reasons. You know, as we look at some of the challenges that we haven't faced yet, things like, you know, how do we grow sales and marketing channels and service networks, and, you know, how do we grow, how do we build 100 harvesters per year? You know, those are the things that you hope, those are problems you hope to have to solve. And to have partners like Kubota and Yamaha who have done those things year after year for 100 years, right? That's a really encouraging thing.
How do you fit into their portfolio? Are you part of their venture fund, their corporate VC money, or are you more strategic?
That's right. It's more of a strict venture investment.
Okay.
But I think we have the opportunity to learn from, to collaborate with them from a strategic perspective, in ways that we haven't even fully explored yet.
And how do those two view one another, right? So we have two different corporate venture funds. Are they in the same space as Yamaha and Kubota? Do they compete outside in other areas?
You know, I don't want to speak for them too much, except to say that I think they both are in many ways revered industrial brands in Japan, and okay. I think they have a deep history that is beyond my comprehension. You know, to the point where they got comfortable co-investing, and I think we're really happy to have that situation.
Okay, and so they add. Have you taken the product to? Are you pre-revenue still, or where are you guys at?
Yeah, so we were the first company in the, as far as I know, the first company in the history of the strawberry industry to pick robotically to sell robotically picked fruit into retail, which is pretty cool. And I think there aren't too many companies who have done that in any fresh produce crop. So we generated our first revenue last year, and now we're at the point where we're expanding and working pretty closely with some customers to. Set the stage for some real serious growth in the next few years.
Okay. So as you think about the long-term vision of the company, right, where do you want to take it?
Yeah, great question. I think we see potential. Any piece of fruit that you buy that's in freshly displayed in the produce case in the grocery store right now is picked by hand. Mm-hmm. And you sort of think about that for a minute, and that doesn't seem sustainable. For many reasons, you know, a lot of the cost pressures I've mentioned, a lot of the fact that the fact that it's really tough work, and the fact that consumers are, you know, ever more demanding. And so we see opportunities to expand what we're doing into a number of different crop areas. And I think what we really would like to do, our long-term vision, is to build a 21st century farming company that's centered around automation. And you look at some of the incumbents, and it doesn't seem like they're any better positioned than, say, we are to take advantage of that opportunity.
So are these products, are they built here? They're more like prototypes, right? Because you're early stage, your revenues are small. Is there a thought that eventually they might be built by companies in Japan or outside of the U.S.?
I think that's totally a path that we could take. But, you know, another thing that we do really well, and another reason, frankly, that I think the tech guys started the business is that we love building things and we can build things. So, you know, we have our part of the first money we put in was building out a machine shop so that we can cut metal and bend metal and weld and everything ourselves. And so it's helped us in speed to market, but also in how we figure out the sort of manufacturing strategy. we're willing to take it on if we have to, but hopefully we'll get to the point where we can learn from some of our strategic partners and advisors about how to scale to beyond that level.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting, you know, you being the finance guy, but you're surrounded by, you're a smart guy, right? But you're surrounded by very smart yet mechanically oriented people, right? The software meets hardware. What when you go through an interview process, what does that look like? I mean, how do you test how sharp the people are? I mean, in terms of like bringing on a new teammate.
Oh, it's a great question. It's you know, not one that I'd say we have a perfect answer for. But for us, what we look for is a portfolio of work. There's nothing that speaks to someone's capabilities more than saying, yeah, you know, in my spare time, I rebuild cars, or do this skill or that skill, or these are some things that I've worked on in the past. And I think that really demonstrates to us two things. One is the pragmatism, and two is just passion. So I think that's one thing. And then the other thing is being based, you know, in farming on a barn, our offices in a barn, you know, with a machine shop. It's not like walking into Facebook headquarters. It's pretty quickly self-selecting when you see someone walk in and they say, this is where I'm going to spend, you know, 60 hours a week for the
next... Okay, well, walk me through. When I walk... Okay, so you just walked into Haney Business, said, hey, cool atmosphere. We have sort of a office... we're trending a little bit to a little more... office space. It's a little... the co-working space kind of thing.
Right.
But when I walk into the barn, what's it... Okay, walk me through it. What's it feel like? What's
the culture? Well, you know, it's 45 degrees out right now, right? You can't insulate... The barn isn't insulated.
Okay.
So you walk in for an 8 a.m. interview, and it's probably 35, you know? And so
you're wearing your jacket in the interview.
You're wearing your jacket in the interview. Your teeth are chattering, and you see people, you know, putting robots together with gloves with their hands shaking. But, you know, some people love that, and they would kill for that more than... being in front of a computer or driving a truck or whatever it is that they were doing. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that's not something you can easily suss out when you bring someone into a nice office environment, because who wouldn't want to work there? You know, for us, it's, you find people and they can't help but smile and ask questions. And, that's a really powerful filtering tool for us.
A certain toughness, so to speak, that goes into that. Okay. So what's the percentage of men versus women in your company? Cause I can picture it being like guys, right? But I don't want to put words in your mouth. I don't know.
No, sadly, we're 100% male, not for lack of trying.
We've tried to hire
some gals in the past without luck.
Yeah, well, my buddy's teaches welding over at Delaware High School, and he's got the same thing with his classes. He's not 100% guys, but it's more often. You know, I guess we as a society have to figure out how to get women more interested in welding in a lot of different areas. So I just sort of wondered with it being sort of a rugged job, would it lend itself more to the guy that's been in the welding class before, or, you know, who's the perfect job candidate?
I'd say anyone with practical experience, building things on the engineering side, whether it's software or, you know, mechanical, we'd love to chat with you. If the idea of working in a barn and building things, or going down into the farm and solving problems with, you know, the limited set of tools in the back of the truck, is appealing to you, then drop me a note.
Okay. I love it. So as you think about the big vision, right, we know this could really change the world. It could solve a lot of the labor problems. And as the technology gets better, it could, put more fresh fruit, stuff to eat on our plates, which makes people more healthy and so on. So, I mean, as you think about that, I mean, what are the big milestones you have to hit? Is there an eventuality where you have to sell the company in order to make that happen? Do you have to take on more investment? I mean, are there big things ahead that are really the game changers for you?
I think for us, the long-term vision is helped by the fact that California is just such a prolific farming environment, right? I mean, we could get into almost any market that we wanted to within 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, you're in a good spot, a good location geographically, yeah.
Great spot. I think the big milestones ahead of us are just finding partners that help, that forward-thinking customer partners who help growers sort of see the light in terms of how you integrate robots onto the farm. You know, how does it work alongside crews? How does the cost structure change? You know, hopefully for the better. Collecting data to demonstrate that, and then just getting, like any startup, hardware startup, getting the equipment reliable enough to to basically open up our options and our customers' options on how to utilize the equipment.
From a customer standpoint, would that be like a Del Monte? I'm trying to think, or a Dole. I'm trying to think of the names of fruit manufacturers or fruits people, right? Sure. It wouldn't be the grocery store. It would be the person that's actually putting the food on the shelf in the grocery store.
Sure. So one of our great customer partners is a company with a Good Farms label. It's a Good Farms, and you'll see those strawberries now all over the place now that I mention it. You know, any Whole Foods or Costco or anything. So Good Farms is an example. Driscoll's is an example. Nature Ripe, those types of companies. Darren's Berries, you know, anywhere from the big fully integrated farm to the independent grower who's working with a bigger shipping label to ship to grocery stores. I think we see an opportunity to go across the spectrum.
Exciting stuff. I can imagine being a fun job. I'm not good with my hands, but you know, I like being outside. I like the idea of figuring out a way to do something nobody else is doing. So super cool. So
thank you.
Just thinking about the next one in line, the advice mm-hmm. for that entrepreneur that's out there that's saying, you know what, I want to do something too. Any advice to that next entrepreneur in line?
Yeah, go for it. You know, I think that it's as simple as that. I think, you know, believe it or not, many members of our team are actually pretty conservative when it comes to risk taking. And I think you can convince yourself that working at a big company in a stable job feels really stable and really safe. But if you're the type of person that that's, you know, it doesn't feel sort of good enough or fulfilling enough, I think that there's less career risk than you think. You know, you can go out and you can develop a great story for even if your startup doesn't pan out or your idea doesn't pan out, you can develop a great story just by how much you've learned and what you have done when you go out and try to start a business. I think the learning there is just so far beyond most of the experiences you can get with a big company.
Yeah. Very cool. What about advice? Last question. I add one more to the list here. Okay, I'm thinking about your teammates. So there's mm-hmm. something cool about being part of a startup. So advice to maybe somebody out there that's in the career mode where, hey, I'm out. I may not have it all together. I don't have my big dream yet. I always tell people, go around somebody else who has a big dream and maybe it'll be infectious. Are there opportunities in being around an early stage company like yours that maybe you don't get when you go to work for a big company?
Sure. I think you have a specific hand in the outcome of what we're doing. I mean, you know, you can point to a part on the harvester that we're building and say, I made that part, and the first one I made broke 10 times, but now I've learned how to make it so that, you know, it's not going to break anymore. And I actually know how to fabricate it too. And, you know, I think there's some having a bigger impact on a sort of a smaller company is a really powerful thing. And even if you don't have the idea sorted out, you know, I think my advice would be just talk to as many people as you can, go through a bunch of bad ideas, and eventually you'll get to a good one, whether it's yours or someone else's, that just really fires you up.
Love it very much. Thank you, Kyle Cobb, Advance Farm. Thanks for sharing your story. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.